Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today from Mina Kim. This hour, many said it was the most important race for district attorney in the nation. Criminal justice reformer George Gascon left his job as San Francisco DA last year and then challenged a tough-on-crime incumbent DA in Los Angeles, defeating her by a narrow margin. Gascon, a staunch opponent of the death penalty, is a strong supporter of recent criminal justice reforms that were opposed by most law enforcement officials. Gascon joins us this hour to discuss his plans for reforming the LA District Attorney's Office, his pledge to reopen investigations into fatal police shootings, and much more. That's next on Forum, right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Mina Kim. Well, last year, George Gascon unexpectedly resigned from his job as San Francisco's district attorney and moved to L.A., where he soon announced he would run against the incumbent district attorney Jackie Lacey, a traditional law and order DA who was seeking a third term. Gascon won, despite fierce opposition from the L.A. Police Officers Union and others. Gascon strongly opposes capital punishment. He has been a longtime supporter of reforming the criminal justice system and looking for alternatives to incarceration. He takes over on December 7th, making him the first person, I believe, to be the top prosecutor in two California counties. George Gascon, welcome back to Forum.
Scott, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Congratulations on your win. Am I correct? You are will be the first person to be the DA in two counties in California?
I believe that maybe in the country.
Well, I didn't want to be too grandiose, but yes, I thought that might be the case.
Haven't had anyone challenge that yet. So, for sure, California. Yeah, two major counties, for sure.
For sure. Well, tell us, what do you think is the significance of your victory? What message do you think Angelenos were sending?
I think, you know, Angelenos were sending a very clear message, as I think the rest of California, that, you know, the reform message is something that it resonates with the public. I think if you look at the election, there were two things that happened at the same time. If you look at the state level, you have Proposition 20, which was an attempt by traditional prosecutors and law enforcement and prison guards to sort of dial back the reforms of Prop 47 and Prop 57 and realignment. And that failed statewide, but it failed, you know, in L.A. County as well. And then in L.A. County, you have my election, which, as you indicated in the opening of the program, it was heavily contested. There was a lot of police union. In fact, you know, the San Francisco Police Officers Association put several hundred thousand dollars into the race, as well as clearly L.A. law enforcement and prosecutors around the state. And they lost, and they lost by a big margin. You know, when all the votes were counted, there was about an 8-point spread, about 250,000 votes more that I got. You know, I got over 2 million people that voted for me. But at the same time that we had that resounding victory for my race in L.A. County, there was also a Measure J, which is an L.A. County measure that talked about reallocating funding from the sort of the carceral part of the criminal justice system, so from, you know, jails and prosecutors and sheriff, and that money is going into mental health services and social services. So there was also that was going on. I think if you put it all together, I think the voters are telling, they're telling law enforcement for sure, look, not only are we not going back, meaning we're not going to go and unwind Prop 47 and 57, but furthermore, we're moving forward. We're moving away from the old system. And what I'm hoping is that prosecutors and law enforcement stop. And when I'm talking about that, I'm talking generally of the unions, the labor organizations, that they stop continuing to fight reform as they have for the last 8 or 9 years. And they join the reform effort, because it's going to happen whether they want to support it or not. But it sure would be nicer if we're not fighting one another and we're working together towards creating it. A more thoughtful and a more humane criminal justice system going into the 21st century and eliminating the systemic racism that has plagued our system for generations.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about more cooperation, but at the same time, you're talking about reopening investigations into fatal police shootings that the current DA, Jackie Lacey, declined to prosecute. I mean, how can you, I mean, that's obviously antithetical to what the unions want to do. How do you find common ground there?
Well, look, I mean, here's the problem, right? When police officers are doing the right things, and sometimes police officers are going to have to use force, including deadly force, in order to protect themselves and others, they need to be supported, right? And I've always been one that supported police officers when they have used force appropriately. However, when police officers are using excessive force and they're violating the law, they need to be held accountable just like anybody else in the community. The credibility, the legitimacy of our system depends on people believing that the system is going to work well and across the board, that you don't have any sacred cows, if you will. And the problem is, frankly, that when there is a lack of credibility and a lack of support, actually are the women and men that are working in uniform in the streets are the ones that actually bear the brunt of that, because, you know, they depend on community believing in their work and wanting them to be there. And what we have right now is we have a tremendous amount of dysfunction because many members, and especially in our black and brown communities, feel that the criminal justice system not only doesn't work for them, but that more critically, that their lives don't matter. And the whole Black Lives Matters movement is really built up around the concept that for years, African Americans in this country, and we know that also Latinos, have often been at the brunt of receiving the brunt of the force by police in ways that was unnecessary and sometimes unlawful.
You were pressured when you were DA here in San Francisco to bring charges against police officers in several high-profile cases, including the Mario Woods killing, which was captured on videotape. That was back in 2015. He had a knife in his hand. I believe he also had mental health problems. He was shot by five officers. And you declined, as you did in the other cases, to bring charges. And you said you would have liked to bring charges, but that you were bound by law not to prosecute. So have things changed? I know that there have been some reforms passed and signed by the governor up in Sacramento. Do you feel now that you have the tools you need to bring charges when it's appropriate?
Well, there's two components to this. Actually, Mario Woods' case was a case that I went out very openly. If you recall, I did a press conference. I said the shooting is unnecessary, but unfortunately, it is lawful. Mario Woods had a knife. He had stabbed someone else. He was holding the knife. The officers told him to drop the knife. He didn't. But I think myself, as is almost anybody else that looked at that tape, that video, they saw that the shooting didn't have to occur. But unfortunately, it was lawful. And the difference, by the way, between the shootings that I faced in San Francisco and the ones that I'm looking to reopen here in L.A., in San Francisco, they were all people that were armed. Now, some cases, as in the case of Mario Woods, I made it publicly known that I thought it was unnecessary. And frankly, I challenged the legislator, and I was the only district attorney that campaigned statewide to change the law. So the law that we have now, I was the only district attorney that actually worked with legislators to get us to that new law. But in L.A. County, we have cases of people that were unarmed, much like in the case, the O'Neill case, that now Chase is going to move on. He's filed that case, which is a case that occurred during my time, but the investigation wasn't completed by the time I left. So what I'm looking to reopen in L.A. County are cases similar to the O'Neill case, where you have people that have been unarmed and they were shot by police in ways that, I believe, and certainly others have reviewed the cases, that they need to be reopened because there are this possibility that they would be unlawful. And, Chase and us moving forward with the O'Neill case, very different cases from the Mario Woods case, unfortunately.
Did you talk with Chase Aboudin? Did he reach out to you before he filed charges?
We haven't talked about the case, but, Chase and I have been, we've been in conversations. As you all know, I supported him to get elected, and he endorsed me during my election here in LA County, and we are both founding members, four DAs. Well, now I can say I'm a DA. I was not a DA at the moment. I was running. Four of us have formed a new organization statewide that is called Prosecutors Alliance, which is actually an alternative to the California District Attorneys Association, where we're trying to bring a more progressive look to the work. So we have been working regularly, and you know, we plan to work together because we're very aligned on the way that we want to see the criminal justice system move forward.
So you think Boudin's decision, then, based on what you know and what you saw as you were investigating that case, that's a correct decision?
I believe so. And, you know, we had not completed the investigation by the time that I left. But based on the preliminary information that I had, I believe that the decision that he's made is a correct decision.
You know, there's a certain irony in all this. You, when you were DA here, you were sort of hounded by protesters at your home in the Mission District in San Francisco. Many of them pressing you with loudspeakers and harassment of all kinds. I believe you had to get a restraining order at one point to keep them away from your front steps. And, you know, now you're in L.A., where there is also a very robust police reform movement that has been harassing the current DA, Jackie Lacey. I don't want to say harassing, but, you know, clearly they've been making their voice heard with her. And yet they're probably partly responsible for your winning this election. Do you see that irony?
You know, I do. And by the way, they definitely were strong supporters of mine. And I would say that a lot of the people in the Black Lives Matter movement and other organizations have really asked that I run for DA here. You know, there is an irony, and I think it's unfortunate that in San Francisco, we had shootings that were unnecessary, which I said so, and unfortunately there were people in the community that for a variety of reasons, and I understand, you know, deep pain, that they just couldn't accept that unfortunately the law wasn't there to prosecute those cases. So they, you know, I think there was a natural human reaction to target me as their, you know, their point of anger. And it was unfortunate. And there's no question that there's an irony in that whole process. I think that people here recognize the problems that I encountered there. And they also recognize a lot of the progressive work that I did in San Francisco, which they would like to see here. I'm moving forward. I think Chase is doing a wonderful job in San Francisco, and I'm hoping that those families will find some reprieve and at least see in a case like the O'Neill case being prosecuted, and there is a new law. Obviously, that will alter the way the cases. I mean, quite frankly, under the current law that is now the state legislation, which is the one that I supported, the Mario Woods case would have been a prosecutable case, but you cannot go retroactively to those cases.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue our conversation with George Gascon, San Francisco's former district attorney, just elected DA in L.A. County. He's got big plans to shake up the nation's largest local prosecutor's office. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or if you like, email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Scott Schaefer in today for Mina Kim. Lots more to talk about. Welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today, this hour, and I'm talking with George Gascon, San Francisco's former district attorney and the district attorney-elect in Los Angeles County. He takes office 1 week from today. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786, or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And George, I want to ask you, you talked about Prop J passing in Los Angeles, which is going to move money away from sort of traditional law enforcement, jails, incarceration, and toward things like mental health. That is essentially, I think, what the defund the police movement meant. And I realize that's a very disparate movement and different people mean different things when they say that. But, you know, there was a lot of feeling in the Democratic Party, especially among moderates, that really cost Democrats in this past election in some of those down ballot races in more purple districts. What are your thoughts about how do you market, if that's the right word, how do you sell this idea to, you know, more, you know, sort of mainstream moderate voters?
Yeah, you know, Scott, Measure J was the beginning of a process of reallocating resources that were, frankly, taken away from mental health and you know, public health years ago. I think the disconnect, I think, is a lot of people forget that we defunded public education and mental health services and public health in this country and in the state about 30 years ago. We started defunding education. You know, we built 22 prisons in the last 30 years. We built one public university. We reduced funding for mental health services. We reduced funding for public housing. You know, per capita, we spend less in public housing today than we did in the early 1980s. So there was a whole defunding process of all the social services and a shifting of that money, reallocating that money into policing, prosecution, and prisons and jails. And we are now sort of paying the price of those mistakes. And to me, the whole issue is an issue of reallocating funds, basically establishing right-sizing of law enforcement and prosecutions. You know, look, there's always going to be policing and prosecutors and jails and prisons. The question is, do they need to be the size that they are today? Should we have police responding to calls that really require somebody that is a mental health expert or a social worker? Do we need to have jails take the place of housing, which we have regularly, especially when we're talking about that mentally ill people, people with substance abuse, which in the last three decades we have gotten used to just simply warehousing them into our jails and our prison systems and replacing, quite frankly, money that was before used for public housing and other housing services. So the conversation that I see taking place in LA County is not that we're going to get rid of policing. Certainly, I don't believe that's appropriate. And I believe that a lot of the voters on, but what we're saying is we need to start shifting the balance. We need to right-size the, you know, the carceral part of the system. And conversely, we need to move money into this other services and then reduce the need to have more policing and more jails and more prisons. That's what I see. And I believe that the problem that some Democrats around the country that are complaining about the defunding the police and stuff is really it's a lack of being able to articulate what is being talked about. There's no question. Look, you're going to have some people on the extreme, right, that are abolitionists. They believe that we should get rid of policing and jails and prison. That is a small minority, certainly not that I agree with. And I think on the right, you have people that believe that we should just get rid of all the services and just lock everybody up, right? And we have done that for the last 30, 40 years in this country and certainly in the state. And I think that what the conversation is doing is the pendulum is coming to the middle. So actually, I would tell the moderates actually that the moderate approach is exactly what Measure J is doing. That is not a radical approach. It's simply right-sizing the system. And unfortunately, I think some people have been unable to articulate this in a way that makes sense for some of the voters.
If you'd like to join our conversation with George Gascone, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or if you prefer, you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Let's go to Oakland now. And Kate, welcome.
Hi, this is Kate Walker Brown. I live in Oakland, but I do a lot of work in Los Angeles, and so I'm really eager to hear how you are going to support victims of human trafficking as you prosecute trafficking cases.
Jerk.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Kate. You know, much like we did in San Francisco, you know, we created a very victim-centered approach to our work, which, number one, doesn't criminalize the victims, because we know that in many places, and quite frankly, in some counties, we have seen often a conversation around fighting human trafficking. But when we look at who's being prosecuted, are usually young women and young men that are actually in sex work, and they're the ones that are being trafficked, and they're the ones that are getting prosecuted. So it's really important to distinguish between the people that are being victimized, especially when it comes to sex work, and being prosecuted and treated as criminals. We stopped doing that in San Francisco shortly after I became a district attorney, and then really targeting those resources, number one, to provide services for those that are being trafficked, and then when appropriate, using the prosecutorial arm to go after those that are actually the real traffickers. And
based
that would
on
what, be the same work that I would be doing in L.A.
Based on what you know in L.A., has L.A. not been doing that? Have they been, you know, continuing to target the sex workers?
Yeah, L.A. has very much done the same thing that, you know, frankly, other counties around the Bay Area have done, you know, and I think, Kate, you probably know really well. Sex workers get prosecuted in many parts of the Bay Area. They didn't in San Francisco, and they have in L.A. In fact, we have seen sometimes even young women in L.A. Having body attachments because they would not cooperate to turn in their pimp, even though that we knew that, you know, that the turning in their pimp would probably lead to serious harm to themselves and their family. So it's understanding you have to thread this needle very finely, but you don't want to criminalize the victims.
All right, Kate, thanks so much for the call. Let's go now to Nevada City. And Ed, you're next.
Hey, how you doing? Good to hear this this debate and the issues covered. I'm an old cop. I retired in the mid-80s on a disability, as most cops do. And we used to always want social services with us when we went to a family dispute call or a mentally disturbed person or something like that, because we didn't want to handle it. And so now cops have, over the last 30 years, cops have evolved to the point where they do handle those things. And it's been inappropriate all this time for cops to handle these things. And now we're getting back to the issue that cops were after in the mid-80s that said, let's get some social workers out here. And, of course, that rebounded with the defunding of public services, because the public felt that it was not appropriate. Well, that was a mistake to do that, and we are now in a very interesting evolution.
Ed, were you? I'm just curious, were you a cop in Nevada County, or where were you?
Monterey County, 5 years, 2 years in Trinity County, and 7 in Placer County.
Okay, good. You know, George, we talked earlier about the Mario Woods case, and there are so many of these incidents where there's a fatal shooting, and you just think, wouldn't it have been nice to have somebody there who could de-escalate the situation? Is that what part of what we're talking about here when you talk about having social workers or people who are more skilled in mental illness and mental health?
Absolutely, Scott. And I just want to thank Ed for raising the issue that he did, because he's absolutely right. You know, I was a cop about the same time that he was a cop too. And you know, we wanted to have, you know, certainly a different, you know, different people that did not necessarily carry a gun on the bash come and handle these cases. And unfortunately, we didn't. And I think the Mario Woods case, Scott, is a perfect example where someone with expertise in mental health handling, a clinician, would have probably handled that case very, very differently. Of course, there are other moving parts to this case, too. I mean, I think that this was a case where, at least in my estimation, the officers prompted the shooting. There was, you know, they had been walking with him for a while. There was really no reason for that one officer to step in front of him and block him, and that then precipitated, under the law at the time, the shooting. But there is no question that a mental health clinician would have probably handled that call very differently. But even other police officers probably would have as well. That was really prompted at the end by what I consider to be an unnecessary strategy by the officers that were at the scene that led to the shooting and the killing.
Yeah. All right, Ed, thanks very much for the call. We have a comment from Butch, who writes, and before I read his comment, let me just say that among the things voters did in November was they rejected Prop 25, which would have eliminated cash bail. That was a referendum on a law that had been signed by the governor. And so we're going to keep cash bail probably, you know, for the foreseeable future. And Butch writes, if you eliminate cash bail, how do you ensure the defendant will show up for trial and court appearances?
Yeah, you know, Bush, and you're right. And the voters rejected Prop 25, I believe, for a couple of reasons. I think it was very confusing. Obviously, it was funded. You know, the Prop 25 people funded that were the bail industry, because they're fighting for their survival. But I think there were a lot of people in the activist community and a lot of social justice reform people that also supported Prop 25 because they believe that the use of algorithms and to assess risk were discriminatory in nature, and they believed that that what needed to happen was to get rid of cash bail, but also get rid of the algorithms. And so they strategically joined forces with the bail industry, the cash bail industry, in a belief that now they can go back and create new law that will still get rid of cash bail. The interesting thing is that there's no evidence that cash bail guarantees that people are going to come back, right? There are a lot of jurisdictions in the country already that stopped using cash bail years ago, and people do show up. And in San Francisco, we started using our PSA. We started to get rid of cash bail to a great extent.
PSA
in San
meaning?
Francisco. Yeah, it was a public safety assessment tool, which was an algorithm that came out of the Arnold Foundation that assessed risk and determine people that could be released without any bail. And we were releasing a lot of people in San Francisco already without bail. And interestingly enough, they were outperforming, meaning they were not committing other crimes and they were coming back to court. They were outperforming the people that were released on bail. So I believe that, you know, cash bail, and certainly I'm going to work hard to make sure that we get rid of cash bail, because the cash bail, what it does is it brings an inequity in the system, where poor people that cannot afford the bail are generally held in pretrial confinement, sometimes for week and month, or they are forced into taking a plea deal that they may not have otherwise. And people that have the capacity to post bail, they get out even if they're dangerous. And we've actually had examples in San Francisco, people posting very high bails and going out and harming others. So there is absolutely no connection between your financial capacity to post bail and you're not being dangerous or being dangerous. So cash bail needs to go. How do we come up with a different system? I think that, you know, there's a lot of conversations around that.
You mentioned a moment ago that you had been a police officer before you were a prosecutor, and you were, I think, a deputy chief in Los Angeles and then chief in Mesa, Arizona, and then you were brought to San Francisco to be the chief of police here before you became DA. How has that journey, and particularly your former experience as a cop, do you think, how has that influenced the way you think about all of these issues, whether it's policing or incarceration or reforms, all of it?
Hugely. You know, Scott, the reality is, you know, and I grew up in the system, right? I was very much part of the 1980s, the mass incarceration. And for me, there was just an evolution that started to occur in the last 20 years, about 10 years before I became the district attorney in San Francisco, where I began to start questioning the utility of the high levels of incarceration that we engage in this country. And obviously, you know, acknowledging the obvious that it was so biased and so racist in its application, because the people that we were arresting often for behavior that would go unnoticed in other communities were generally poor people, black people, brown people. And so by the time I became a district attorney in 2011, I had a very clear focus that reducing incarceration was going to be one of my main objective, and to do so in a way that it was safe. And we went about reducing our incarceration levels in San Francisco. And interestingly enough, our violent crime continued to stay down to historic levels through the entire period of time that I was a district attorney. Now, we had a large increase in car break-ins. We had 81,000 car break-ins in the San Francisco Police Department under the prior leadership, not the current. Only made 13 arrests, which we prosecuted about 80% of those. But basically, our property crimes went off the scale vastly because there was a complete retreat by the police department dealing with car break-ins. Chief came in. He started to look at those, and we had those reduced as well.
Yeah, but as you know, a lot of people also blame Prop 47 for that and making it hard, increasing the threshold for charging a felony. And that was one of the things that Prop 20 would have changed, and it failed. But do you reject that idea that that reform has contributed to the increase in property crime?
100%. Look, let's take San Francisco and let's look at car break-ins, okay? I know that the police officers would generally, and the POA would tell people, this is because of Prop 47. But Prop 47 doesn't cover car break-ins, right? You could steal a $5 piece of property from a car by breaking into it, and it's a felony. So it's never been the case that Prop 47 had anything to do with car break-ins. It's never been the case that Prop 47 had anything to do with burglaries, residential burglary. It never been the case that had anything to do with robberies. The problem is that, unfortunately, some people in police leadership decided that they were going to fight reform, and the way that you fight reform was they were not going to do anything about it. So you had 81,000 car break-ins, not covered by Prop 47, but there were 13 arrests. And every time you had your car broken into, they were told, go and fill up a report online, because there's nothing that we can do. Instead of what is happening since then, we have new leadership in the police department. Chief Scott, he worked with the DA's office. We started identifying some of the people that were prolific car burglars that started to target them, started to arrest them. And we saw in immediate, within 18 months, we saw about a 17-18% decrease in car break-ins during the time that I was a district attorney there. So the problem is that, you know, we need to get people to stay focused on what their work is and not blame things that are not necessarily within their control, number one. Number two, because the public has spoken, but lying to the public, which I saw that happening over and over again. And that's why Prop 20 failed, by the way, because the public realized that they were being lied to.
We're coming up on a break, but George writes, and I believe he himself is Cuban-American. How does being a Cuban-American, what does that mean to you? Why are you not Republican? I think you were at one point, like most Cuban-Americans. And do you support repeal of the Cuban Adjustment Act? We want to get into that too deeply. But, you know, what are your thoughts about that? You were born in Havana, brought to the U.S. as a kid.
Yeah, look, I mean, I used to tell people that, you know, your party affiliation when you're a young person is like your religion. My parents were Catholic, so I became a Catholic. My parents came to this country, like most Cuban Americans, running away from communism, and they became Republicans. And I was a Republican for years. And then I felt that I was completely disconnected by many of the Republican values. And so I moved away from the Republican Party. I was never, by the way, unlike my parents who were straight ticket voters, you know, my dad... God bless him, you know, he would not vote for a Democrat. I never did that. I actually very proudly, in fact, one of the biggest fights we had in my family is that I voted for Bill Clinton. And, you know, I thought Bill Clinton was one of the best presidents that we ever had. And I campaigned for Barack Obama in Arizona.
Arizona is now turned purple, which was a big deal in this last election. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have to take a short break. We're going to continue, though, our conversation with George Gascon. You can give us a call, 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Stay with us for more of our conversation with George Gascon.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim, talking with George Gascon, the DA-elect in L.A. County. And let's go to the phones. Don, in San Francisco, you're next.
Hi. I wish the people of L.A. County the best of luck with their new DA. I also am a former cop and was a crime victim in San Francisco, where, as the DA said, they failed to do their job, and then the mayor failed to do her job. But when I approached the DA to address this issue, the DA failed to do his job. And as a result, I ended up homeless. So all that stuff sounds great, but it's all about where the rubber meets the road. What about the victims?
Yeah, well, maybe, George, maybe without going into the details of a case that we don't really know a lot of details about, what about victims? I mean, that is something that Chase Boudin has talked about addressing, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, Don, I don't know anything about your case, certainly the victims are important. I'm sorry that you wound up homeless, by the way. But, you know, in San Francisco, we actually created what has become a model for trauma-informed victims cared. We increased the number of victims that were treated and that were handled by the San Francisco District Attorney's Office by more than twofold. We actually put we decentralized victim services. We put victim services out into the community. We lobby statewide to make sure that the victims' compensation would be more inclusive. So there's no question that a victim-centered approach is critical, and that is something that we did in San Francisco. And that involves being trauma-informed in the way that we do our work. And San Francisco has one of the best victim services unit in the state. It has become a model. One of the things that I did is we, instead of having a lawyer running that unit, we brought a doctor in psychology that was trained on trauma-informed care, Dr. Gina Castro, who has done an incredible job. She's, she's one of the leaders now nationally in providing a victim service center approach out of a district attorney's office. So a big component of our work is dealing with victims and recognizing, by the way, that if you leave untreated trauma, often people that are victimized today, they end up victimizing other people. In fact, Dr. Custer used to say that hurt people hurt other people, heal people heal other people. So unquestionably, we have to make sure that we do right by the victims. And by the way, doing right by the victims doesn't necessarily always mean that you're going to incarcerate somebody to the fullest extent of the law. What it does is taking care of the victim's need and repairing the harm. And, you know, and that's the approach that needs to be taken.
All right, Don, thanks for the call. Best of luck to you. And let's go now to Arizona, your old stomping ground, George. Juliana is on the phone. Welcome.
Hi there. I am a former crisis worker, and I have some thoughts about this, you know, conversation about defunding the police, or at least moving away some services from what the police have been doing, which they're generally not trained to be doing mental health intervention, but everybody's saying, let's give it to the social workers. Well, we also have to keep in mind that for many Black, Indigenous, and Latinx family, social workers have been in adversarial relationships with our communities. We lost an entire generation of Indigenous children in the 60s scoop. So for some communities, social workers don't have the best relationships. They are not always trained in mental health crisis intervention. And some people feel like it would be better to have people whose profession is actually mental health crisis intervention doing the work that now police are doing rather than social workers who are seen as part of a system that has been generally oppressive, not helpful, involved in the breaking up of families. You can look at the Hart children, that whole situation that went down. And I know not all social workers, but plenty of social workers. Yeah. In my own family, my sister lost custody for a while, and the relationship with that social worker was always adversarial. So they aren't necessarily always progressive people. They aren't always, you know, social justice oriented, despite the name of the profession. You know, there's individuals, yeah, and they have their own bias and education. So I think it's probably better to have a group of people who are specifically trained in mental health de-escalation, whose go-to is not take somebody away from their family, but maybe trying to find some other ways that are not traditionally in the realm of what social workers have done, because a lot of what they have done has harmed communities of color.
Yeah. Juliana, thank you for that. And George, you know, you could certainly train police officers to do de-escalation, and maybe they're already trained in some places, I don't know, but they wouldn't necessarily have to be specifically a social worker, although they certainly could be.
Yeah, and Don, I think that, you know, Juliana is absolutely right. And if I misspoke in any way or shape, we're talking about the work that needs to be done by mental health professionals would be done by mental health professionals. The work that needs to be done by social workers will be done by social workers. So there are two different components. And to the last part of the question that you brought up, Scott, the issue of training police to de-escalate, absolutely they need de-escalation training, but trying to make a police officer a clinical psychologist or a clinician in psychology is not a good allocation of resources. There are too many forces that are competing there, and it's better that we allow people that actually go into the workforce to become clinicians and deal with mental health issues and do that work and not try to make police officers something that they really are not wired to do.
But clearly, even including social workers, mental health workers in this mix, it's not a panacea, right?
No, look, I mean, we have to also have the services, right? One of the problems is, again, I go back to this because it's important to recognize, we defunded mental health services in this state and in this country about four decades ago. And we basically replaced mental health services with policing and incarceration. We have to go back to create the bandwidth to have the services. A lot of this work should be done in a way that, you know, avoids the crises. Not to say that there will not be crises, but a lot of this work could be avoided. I'm talking about the crisis work. If there were good mental health services in place in the community where people are being encouraged to take the medication, where they have the right treatments, where, you know, there's early intervention. You know, what we see the police coming into is actually the reflection of all the other failures of the system, right? So it is not a panacea. You cannot just simply think that you're going to solve the problem just by having, you know, people with white coats responding to crises on the street. That has to start much earlier. You have to start providing the bandwidth for treatment and services early on, which will reduce the need to have people responding to a crisis intervention in the street.
All right.
You do have to go to the crisis in the street. You should have somebody that's been trained to do that.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. And Richard in San Francisco, you're next.
Yes, hi, thanks. The claim that bail does not encourage people to show up in court, I've never seen any study that shows that. The fact that there are a few exceptions or a certain number of exceptions doesn't mean that they're not effective. In fact, when people are putting up their houses and their life savings and all the money they have, friends and family of the accused, they have a much greater incentive to show up in court. So whatever study you're referencing, I'd love to see it and know what that is. But I don't believe that it's not effective. And the fact that there are exceptions does not mean that bail is not effective.
George?
Thank you.
Yeah, Richard. I mean, look, there's no question there's a coercive factor when people put their homes in order to come back to court. What we don't address with cash bail is all the people that have to stay in pretrial confinement because they cannot afford bail. Because a lot of people that are there, they don't have the money, so they stay there, not because they're dangerous, but simply because they do not have the home to get a second trustee or get whatever. The other part that is not addressed here is how often poor people will get a relative, will get grandma or, you know, somebody in the family to take a second trustee to put the bail in, and then the case gets dismissed, but they're out of that money that they had to put forward. So the problem about cash bail, it's not that it doesn't have a coercive impact. It clearly does. The problem is that you have a lot of other people that are left harmed by the process because they cannot afford to put money on the table. The other component too is that people that do put money on the table, they sometimes go out and commit pretty serious crimes because they were violent and they should not have been released. Whereas people that were not violent do not get released because they do not have the capacity to put the money. The bottom line is that money doesn't equate to danger. It just simply provides a vehicle for the people that can afford to get out, even if they're dangerous, and for people that may not be dangerous to remain in prison or jail, in jail, on pretrial confinement, and often force or coerce into taking a plea deal when they shouldn't.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about your predecessor. Kamala Harris is now, of course, Vice President-elect of the United States. She portrayed herself as a progressive prosecutor. You worked with her in San Francisco. What are your thoughts about her becoming vice president? Aside from the historic nature of it, what impact might somebody with her background have?
Look, I think it's wonderful. I think that Kamala will bring a level of understanding about what needs to happen in our criminal justice system that very few people could. You know, she was definitely a progressive for her time. I think also I'm always very, you know, very careful. I tell people, you know, this movement has continued to evolve. And but, you know, she did some really progressive things like, you know, how to, you know, get people diverted from court and drug cases very early on. And frankly, I believe that her experience as a district attorney in San Francisco and her experience as the attorney general provides her with a wealth of information and insight that will help this incoming administration to really begin to look at reform from the federal level. You know, there are two components to reform. Obviously, the locals, we have a lot of work to do. And when it comes to incarceration, really is driven by locals. It's not by the federal system. But there's a great deal that the federal system can do to encourage reform measures and the evolution of the system by granting money and by helping with the practices at the local level. And I believe that Kamala is uniquely qualified to get that done.
It is really extraordinary to have somebody from San Francisco be both the Speaker of the House of Representatives and Vice President of the United States. It's quite something. You're listening to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. We're talking with George Gascon, San Francisco's former district attorney, just elected DA in Los Angeles, rather. You know, one of the issues you've talked about is the death penalty. And there, you know, there, as you know, hasn't been an execution in California since, I think, 2006. There is currently a moratorium on executions put in place by the governor, Gavin Newsom. And the current DA, Jackie Lacey, often sought the death penalty as DA. You're going to stop doing that. I know you haven't. You're not a supporter, so I'm not surprised. But you know, what impact might that have? Do you think?
Well, it will have a huge impact. Number one, I think that the reality is that until the death penalty comes out of the books, it could be reactivated at any time. I think that one of the reasons why the governor put a moratorium is because he recognized that there were many people in the system that had already exhausted all their appellate processes. And with the one drug protocol that was approved, that he was going to be presiding over probably one of the largest periods in our history of executions. And he did not want to do that for many good reasons. So I think it's important to recognize that it's really up to district attorneys not to put more people into the system until we abolish the death penalty. And unfortunately, the current district attorney for another week continued to put people in their throat even after the moratorium. She put, in fact, 22 or 23 people in their throat in the last 7 years, about a third of all the people in death row in California, which is roughly about 700, come from LA County. So it is critically important for someone that believes in abolishing the death penalty, which I do, to make sure that we don't put any more people in the system, and then that we work to get other people out of that death penalty. And it has both a financial implication and obviously has a social implication. You know, people that are prosecuted for, you know, under the death penalty track, the cost of litigation and then the cost of incarceration is tremendously higher with really no return on that investment because it doesn't deter crimes. It doesn't really have any other impact other than just simply costing us a lot of money. And then we have to look at the potential that an innocent person may end up being executed, which we know. I mean, in fact, out of this LA County office, we have seen there's somewhere around 2,000 claims of wrongful convictions, which also this office hasn't attended to. So there are many components to why it's important to stop sending people to death row as we work towards the abolishment of the death penalty.
Well, and you also talked about being retroactive and working to reverse death sentences to life without parole. How does that work? And what about victims' families in that process?
Yeah, I mean, and look, I mean, there's no question that we will have to have conversations with victims' family. But here's where, you know, and this is a conversation that I have with many victims' families in San Francisco when I was a district attorney, because, you know, we have people that came to my office wanting me to seek the death penalty. But when people understand that the process of death penalty, even if an execution were to occur, is so protracted, you're looking at decades where they're going to be consistently over and over again ripping that band-aid off and having to relive the horrors of the initial event where their family or their loved one was murdered, and having to deal with that over and over again. Whereas if you get away from the death penalty process, you know, there is some finality to the legal process. Obviously, people are never going to be made whole, right? You lost a family member, and that is forever going to be the case. But reliving the process over and over again because of a failed system in the death penalty is not necessarily good for the families either. So, yes, we're going to be having conversations with family members, but we also have to look at the fact that the people that we have in death row are costing California taxpayers millions and millions of dollars that could be reinvested in mental health services and many other things that are likely actually to reduce the number of murders and other crimes that occur every day.
Just about a minute left, but I want to ask you, the legislature comes back into session next week. They've gotten a lot of reforms done over the past few years. What would you like to see them do that hasn't been done, that's been tried and failed, or maybe something altogether different?
Yeah, I think, I think that we need to continue to work. There's things like, for instance, in the last legislative session, there was an attempt to create a certification process for law enforcement officers that if they get terminated from one place, they do not get to continue to go into another place and become a police officer again, that there's sort of centralized licensing process, much like you do for attorneys and doctors and other professionals. So, you know, that's something that I'm very interested in. And there will be other things that we're going to be looking at. Obviously, the whole issue of cash bail is something that we're going to revisit. So it's a lot of work to be done.
All right. And you take office a week from today. Is that right?
That's correct. Next Monday.
All right. Well, best of luck to you, George Gascon. And obviously, there'll be a lot of attention on you as you become the first person ever in the country to be the district attorney in two counties. So thanks very much for, you know, stepping up, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. And by the way, I just want to shout out for Michael Krasny for all the incredible service he provided to our community, and wish him a wonderful retirement.
All right. Thanks so much. We'll pass that along in case he's not listening. George Gascon, the district attorney-elect in Los Angeles County. I'm sure he's listening. Take care. And good luck to you. Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. I'll be back tomorrow, and we hope that you'll join us then. Have a great day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.